you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Nick Mason on the show. Nick is a researcher, and he is the co-host of Myth of the 20th Century. Nick, how are you there? How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So, Myth of the 20th Century, you want to explain what that is to our listeners?
It's a revisionist history program me and my co-hosts do once a week, and we cover topics from all across the 20th century, usually with some degree of American focus, because majority of our listeners are Americans and we ourselves are all Americans. So there's a lot of 20th century topics that we don't really get into as much, that fall a little too far outside of the, it's, you're talking about 100 years. You could do this for an entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we like to poke around in the areas of history that are not as well covered or talked about. And we do come from a broadly right-wing perspective.
And Chris, people can get that on YouTube, right?
Yes, and we have a website as well.
Okay.
I believe you can get there from myth20c.com.
Okay.
We also have a magazine, newspaper, blog, however you want to say it, various different contributors that are not just us, called The American Sun. You can find that at theamericansun.com, I believe.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm aware of that. I check that every so often to see the articles that you put. Usually it's like a couple articles a day gets posted there, from what I mean.
Yeah, we just got started not too long ago on that project, and so we're gathering some writers together, and I got a lot of things I'm working on personally.
And it's almost just a broad area topic, whatever once someone feels about writing about, right? And
yeah, pretty much. Playing around with the idea of American revisionism as a broader topic, not just American historical revisionism, but American ideological revisionism as well, which I think will dovetail a little bit into what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here we have what I wanted to talk about, and I think you wanted to talk about, is the interventionism, America's crusades, or the American crusade of the past century, and opposition to American interventionism. People call it isolationism, but really it's just non-interventionism. Obviously, people, America has never been isolated. They've engaged in foreign trade. There's travel, cultural exchanges, these things, economic relationships. I guess you could say the advocates of interventionism and empire call it isolationism, to sort of marginalize it, make it sort of irresponsible or not a realistic outlook on the world, how to deal with a dangerous world. So your take on, let's say, here we are, where you just observed the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the Great Slaughter, the Great War, the First World War. And so what's your take on this? How do you want to get wade into this?
Well, I think that I remember a while back reading a book by the popular historian Barbara Tuchman. It was called, there were two. Her famous book is The Guns of August, which it's actually a fairly decent book about the origins of the First World War. Wouldn't necessarily be my first pick, but another of her books that I actually really enjoyed was a collection of various essays about the turn of the century called The Proud Tower. And one place to start, I don't think we need to go too far into it, but American interventionism on the global scene really probably began with the Philippines. It's probably the first place to mark that off. But following that, the American intervention, the European War, is of far more significance.
Yeah, I guess you could say you speak of the so-called Spanish-American War, where America, used that as a pretext not only to seize the remainder of the Spanish Empire in the Caribbean, namely Cuba, Puerto Rico, but this is where we got bases in Guam, and this is in the Philippines, and of course, just before that, in the 1890s, you had the coup in Hawaii, which grabbed Hawaii for the benefit of, I guess, various business interests. This is the sugar trust, that they said back then.
The pineapple wars.
Yeah. You know, and so this sort of set the stage, because this puts America in the Pacific, closer to Asia. And that sets the stage for the, for the Pacific War, 40, 45 years later.
Yeah, America, I mean, as people know the story, I think largely of American intervention into the European War. Obviously, a lot of blame rests on Woodrow Wilson and Woodrow Wilson's right-hand man as well, who gets some discussion among certain revisionists. He's actually pretty well known, which would be the bizarrely named Colonel Edward Mandel House, who is in many ways kind of the man behind the curtain when it comes to Wilson, who was a very vain and egotistical guy who was probably easily controlled by his ambitions.
Yeah, he was had a very childish, almost childish outlook on things, at least his public utterances, his view of Americanism, monarchy, democracy, these things. And I think Edward Mandel House, isn't he the one that wrote that book?
Colonel Drew, Philip Drew, Administrator,
yeah.
Which I have never read. In fact, I've been meaning to read it, but every little snippet I've read of it is just so bad that it's hard to slug through it. But yeah, it basically presents sort of a messianic, as far as I understand, again, having not read the book myself, but read people writing about it. It's apparently a sort of a messianic vision of a world administrative state.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's something that would come to fruition with at least the administrative state with the world wars, because the planning that was necessary for the war effort.
The war effort planning was talk about progressivism in the progressive era. It was the war allowed for the centralization. I mean, it's kind of the old paleocon talking point when they talk about centralization, but it allowed for the Northeast financial interests to ascend to far greater political control and then start to have influence over foreign policy in a way that before there wasn't a lot of foreign policy to speak of, and they were able to create the war industry.
Yeah, the permanent war industry, which really got going in the middle of the 20th century. The arsenal of democracy, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt called it, became the military-industrial complex, became permanent. But leading into the war, obviously, you have the War of 1812. Now, the War of 1812 was short. Spanish-American War was short. There was no conscription. It was all volunteer. It was primarily, I mean, of course, you had, you know, the events in Cuba and San Juan Hill, and Teddy Roosevelt, you know, had a good war, as they say. You had the destruction of the Spanish fleet out in Manila Bay, and these things. And then the consequences of the long-term military occupation of the Philippines, a very brutal war in the Philippines to pacify the Philippines, and these things. But it didn't have quite the effect that on the country that later wars would have on the country. The big event was probably America's entry into the First World War, into the European War going on there. And obviously Woodrow Wilson's almost seemed to have been selected for that very thing, which would suggest perhaps there was some planning. necessarily this bolt from the blue, you know, event that there were war plans. The British had organized with the French. They had the Entente Cordiale, and you had the British strategy, the Mackinder Doctrine, these things challenging German and also Russian power on the continent.
Wilson was a good choice for that, considering his prior political career consisted of managing very poorly various interventions in Latin America and in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, America really got roped in once keep in mind the WASP elite at the time were intensely Anglophilic, and they really, the idea of, you know, helping England against Germany was a very natural thing for them. But as well as the business interests themselves, especially after the British blockade, the starvation blockade of Germany, because that effectively cut off trade between the United States and Germany. So now the financial ties in that sense were sealed. And you had, for instance, the House of Morgan became the coordinator of supplies for Britain. And America did become the arsenal of the British military.
Yeah, and that was, as you mentioned, as you say, it was the result of Britain's illegal blockading, also the mining of neutral waters to cut Germany off. And this, while I think it was, U.S. trade with Germany was cut by like 95%
right.
by 1915, trade with Great Britain skyrocketed because of this. And this also funded a huge war and munitions industry here, which would ultimately enrich families like the Bushes, right? Samuel P. Bush was enriched by it, working for the Warren Industries Board.
Right, and the British Admiralty declared basically the whole of the North Sea a military area. And the intention was starvation. I mean, Churchill said, I have a Churchill quote somewhere here, starve the whole population, men, women, and children, old and young, wounded and sound, into submission.
Yeah. And that was, yeah, it was, the idea was to starve the wounded children. And the, of course, as you mentioned, the, you know, the House of Morgan, Wall Street was carrying or funding, marketing much of the war bonds that were being issued by the Triple Entente. And so it became in their financial interest that they would prevail over Germany. And that I think carried considerable weight in Washington, because that's what whose opinion mattered. Middle part of the country, the ethnic America, whether there's the Germans or the Irish, the Poles, you know, the Italians, they didn't really seem to matter much. It was the Eastern Seaboard elite, as you mentioned, was extremely Anglophile.
And their house organs all ran cover for this in a major way. Most importantly, probably, would be the Wall Street Journal,
mm-hmm.
which never even bothered with the pretense of neutrality.
And there was a concerted effort to control the media. I think it was Oscar Calloway, the senator, who in the well of the Senate had said that the House of Morgan and the Wall Street interests had bought out about a dozen of the major newspapers in the country, which controlled the news feed. So you had a bought-off media even back then. Well, things never change.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing that stays the same. And things got worse with the absolutely insane commitment on the part of, I mean, from the perspective of the criminals at fault here. It was a maneuver in their interest, but America pledging support, pledging to protect American citizens who would be sailing on a ship flying a belligerent flag, the British flag in that case.
Yeah, this would be the Lusitania, which was a auxiliary vessel in the British Navy. In fact, its construction was subsidized by the British state for that very purpose. And it had been given, such vessels had been given orders to ram German submarines. They were by no means neutral. Germany tried to publish warnings in newspapers, which were then put on, you know, the last page or, you know, page 12 in the back. And they had issued specific warnings not to travel on armed merchant vessels in declared war zones.
A belligerent flag.
Yeah, and people forget that the Lusitania was sunk off the Irish coast, wasn't off New York.
Right, exactly.
You know, and not to mention the intrigue involving that, with meaning that the ship was set up to sink, because there's a lot in the documents and the communications. I think it was the British king at the time said the day the Lusitania sunk, he had made reference to possibly the ship sinking and causing cause for America's entry into war. Now, of course, that was, I think it was 1915, so it took a while, because even, you know, it was bad optics. You know, it's like babies. You know, there's photographs of drowned babies and these things. I think 120 Americans died on Lusitania, 1,100 people total, 1,150, 1,198, something like almost 1,200.
I think it was 124 Americans who were killed. And the, I guess it's worth mentioning some of the people who were opposed to this madness. Oh, well, I can only really think of one, at least in the highest levels of government. And say what you will about William Jennings Bryan, but he was not having any of this. Mm-hmm. I actually have a quote from Bryan. He said, Germany has a right to prevent contraband going to the Allies, and a ship carrying contraband should not rely upon passengers to protect her from attack. It would be like putting women and children in front of an army.
Yeah, it's like having a picnic on the sun or something. Hey, wait a second. We're having a picnic. Don't fire on us.
Yeah, and he was in the escalating conflict Bryan was having with Wilson. He eventually said, why be shocked by the drowning of a few people if there is no objection to starving a nation?
Yeah, but see, I guess the starvation is mundane. There's no optics there, right? Whereas you can get a photograph, just like today you have like a baby drowning on a beach, right? Or a kid drowning on a beach, and that becomes the excuse for this mass migration crisis into Europe. And it's the photographs, you know, that matter, the film.
Yeah, Bryan eventually resigned over this.
Mm-hmm. But he was up against some – it wasn't a rational argument, because he was going up against interests, the established financial interest, which had – against the interest of the American people. And, I mean, obviously, we talked about Wall Street and their interests. That's clear. But there was also Woodrow Wilson actually was, looking back at it, he was the first president to get, like, unified Jewish support.
Mm-hmm.
And that factors into the Zionist project, and as that's one of the major, I think, causes of the war, was the realization among those who were supporting Zionism, once Palestine had been targeted, that a general conflict was necessary to bring about its fulfillment. It turns out it took a couple of major conflicts to ultimately bring it about. But Wilson was very
the peace got it going.
Yeah,
I mean That's really the roots of the present world order, was the so-called peace after the first European war.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder too, because in the popular American consciousness, World War II has a very clear mythology. It's you know, you have to defeat pure evil, Hitler, blah 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 blah. But World War I, I mean, it really doesn't get talked a lot about. I doubt it's taught very thoroughly in American schools. I don't really know what the popular conception of World War I is, besides, oh, this was a, I guess some people have some understanding this was just some great tragedy, but what business did America have being involved in this? I guess the idea is maybe Woodrow Wilson was an idealist. You hear this bandied about a lot.
This is, you know, his 15 points, or was it 19 points or 15 points?
I think it was 19.
19 points. Yeah, right, whatever. Yeah. It was like the four freedoms. I got these, I get these things confused.
With FDR's four freedoms.
These slogans. His idealism. He was naive in these things. And perhaps there is some truth to that. So that made him also a tool. He was also compromised, from what I understand. He had a weakness for women, had affairs. And the British and also the Zionists knew this. So they had him blackmailed. Within his, he was the first president to appoint a Jew to the Supreme Court, Louis Brandeis, who turns out was a mm-hmm. Zionist agent.
Mm-hmm. Yes, big time Zionist agent.
And so this factor, because he, although he was a judge, he also consulted prior to that, was an advisor to Roosevelt. He also, Brandeis would also advise Franklin Delano Roosevelt 20 years later.
Yeah, and I believe Brandeis would have had several private meetings with Ben Gurion
mm-hmm.
in the later days.
Well, he was part of that secret society, the Purushim, I think it's called. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and so and he was involved with Untermeyer and these things. You know, this is part of the Balfour Declaration, which, of course, the whole issue of the although it's November 1917, the details have been worked out prior to America's entry. And the whole idea was if Britain declares, you know, Palestine the Jewish homeland, the Jewish power will be used to get America into the war, and which they succeeded in doing, evidently.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea of, because half a dozen ships had been sunk, they were shipping arms to Great Britain was a reason for the United States to go to war. And all of a sudden, then you have the madness, you know, war fever. Then you have all this war fever. Everything German becomes evil. You have, you know, Edward Bernays, I think, goes to work. So with same with Walter Lippmann, and mm-hmm. they start with propaganda, and they realize all of a sudden you have, you know, paintings of Germans as baboons, gorillas holding, you know, carrying off women, and you have all the atrocity reports out of Belgium and these things, wild exaggerations and these things. That's the origins of the soap story. I think it was World War I. It wasn't World War II.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there was a lot of recycled atrocity propaganda from the first European war to the second.
I think it was the Bryce Report that apparently laid out this British lawyer or jurist laid out this report, German atrocities and these things. And so this sets the tone. And they're off for the races. The war fever kicks in, and that's when, it was very controversial because when Woodrow Wilson asked for a declaration of war, he had actually told some congressmen that the conscription wouldn't be necessary.
Mm.
Then it became necessary, conscription, because this was the first time that Americans were being drafted as an expeditionary force. It was very unpopular. That's when they came up with the idea of this, so these draft boards where little local tyrants would be set up to draft people. It wasn't directly with the government.
And there were, of course, the measures they took to suppress dissent in the homeland.
Yes, it turns out it wasn't the Kaiser suppressing our freedom. It was Woodrow Wilson. And,
right.
It was the Espionage Act and the...
Yep.
And what was the other one? The Sedition Act?
Sedition Act, yes.
And the Sedition Act would be criticizing the policies of the U.S. government's sedition. Dissent became disloyalty in this, you know. And I think it was one, who was Eugene Debs went to jail for reciting the Bill of Rights in public, speaking out against the draft. And that was considered espionage to criticize conscription.
Yeah, even though they're unwilling to explain what exactly the American interests are at stake here.
Yeah, that's how crazy it is. And the Supreme Court comes along and declares conscription constitutional, even though you had the 13th Amendment, supposedly banned involuntary servitude. But, you know, I think the ruling said because Germany and Russia do it, we can do it. Well, so much for American exceptionalism.
Right, throw that out the window.
You know, well, we can't conscript when we'll fight this war. And so... I mean, yeah, it's crazy. I think there was one director who went to jail for making a patriotic movie about the American Revolutionary War, which portrayed the British in a bad light.
Oh, wow. I had not heard that. That is fascinating.
So that's, you know, this is the first time you had Hollywood celebrities promoting war bonds. I know Hollywood was in its infancy, but you had, you know, people like I think it was, what's her name? You know, the silent era. Buster Crabbe and who was the other guy? You know, the guy, Prisoner of Zenda, that guy. All those old names from the silent
era. I'm trying to remember my old
Mary Pickford, film. You know. You know, they would sell war bonds and buy bonds. So Hollywood was being used, the media was being used. So that was interesting. But the war happened. Of course, America enters into the war at a critical moment. The Ludendorff offensive fails, and Doughboys start showing up in the summer of 1917, and then the fall of 1917. And then it was 1918. The Ludendorff offensive fails, and by the summer. This series of defeats in Germany, you know, although never being occupied, sues for peace under Wilson's terms, which then again are repudiated at the Versailles Peace Conference.
Yeah, one thing also for the American involvement at this point is this begins the debt war finance process.
That's interesting. Get into that because.
Well, I had a few numbers on that. Basically, in 1915, the national debt was around $1 billion. And by 1919, we're talking about $25 billion. And, of course, you also have the expansion of the federal employment in order to work in the growing apparatus of the war state, the war centralization. You had not too many people working, and then a doubling to 450,000 by 1918. And to keep in mind as well that the income tax came about in 1913, which was really a necessary condition for this process.
That's right, because income tax, I think, started out between 1 and 7%, and within a year it was 70% because of the war.
Yeah, it was 13% was the original maximum in the highest bracket. It was like 1 to 6 or 1 to 7 for the lower brackets, but the highest bracket was 13%. And yes, that went up to 77%.
Within 4 years.
Yeah.
And of course, the creation of the Federal Reserve is the same year, December 1913.
Yeah, hardly a coincidence.
Not a coincidence, because obviously, and that fundamentally changed, because I think when the Federal Reserve first created, David Stockman makes his point where how it was rather conservative in its powers. It was supposed to be there as a lender of last resort, and they would again monetize corporate paper in order to avert a bank run, more or less. And immediately, because of the war. The Federal Reserve was given powers to monetize federal debt, meaning print money to buy bonds. And that's what they did during the war. And they've never looked back after that. I think we're still paying off debt from First World War. So it's a compound interest, the gift that never stops giving, right? For the creditor.
Yeah, I think, there are many, many things that have outlived World War One. I think that I mentioned earlier, I was sort of considering how it is that the average American who went through the American public school system thinks about the First World War. But I think the Second World War in every respect overshadows it because of the propaganda about Germans in the Second World War has been laid on so thick and so heavy that it's very easy for people to believe that the German is just like Germans are naturally the aggressors. And even in the case of the First World War, they have to believe this.
Yeah, because the outbreak of war in 1914 is, even by the official narrative, convoluted. And we're led to believe that was what led to it was a series of diplomatic missteps, the alliance system, war by timetables, as some people have referred to it, and just militarism, nationalism, and these things. And so, but the outbreak of the Second World War, we're told that it begins September 1st, 1939, preludes being Munich and Austria, and also what was going on in the South Pacific, going on in Asia with Japan and these things. And this, we're talk about, the age of aggression, the aggressor states. We're led to believe that Germany and Japan are uniquely aggressive and militaristic. In a world that's dominated by the British, the Anglo-American Empire, which actually, I guess, gained its power over the world by consent, I guess, right?
Right, yeah, consent, exactly. And you have the also the wars for democracy that continues to this day in the form of the R2P type logic for so-called humanitarian intervention, read regime change.
Well, first, talk about the consequences of the First World War. Obviously, the conditions or conflicts that led to the outbreak of war again in Europe in 1939, these conditions were created by the Versailles Treaty. The consequences of the peace, as John Maynard Keynes referred to it as. Want to go over
that? His absolutely his best book.
Mm-hmm. So what were what grew out of the First World War? You know, obviously what's going on in Russia and Germany, right? It simply would have been possible if the war had been shortened or avoided in 1914, right?
Yeah, and the punitive measures had not been put in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, Germany was expected to assume war guilt.
Yeah, that was the war guilt clause. Well, you know.
Yeah, which is absurd. Yes. I mean, by international law, it was absurd. It's absurd on its face. But yeah, I mean, a big outcome of the First World War is Bolshevik Russia. Mm-hmm. The Tsarist army was, I believe, the largest in the world at the time. And the idea that Lenin and his cohorts would have been able to overthrow Russia had the army not been decimated and the government put into chaos is difficult to believe.
Yeah, and also think at the outbreak, Lenin and Trotsky were exiles, right?
Yes, and of course, he was put on a train to the Finland station.
I think both the German Max Warburg and the other Warburg were responsible for both Trotsky and Lenin finding the way back into Russia. Strange how that works out.
I think Jacob Schiff as well had a hand in it.
Yep, because he had. Well, ironically, yeah, because the war broke out, the Jews were American Jews were largely pro German because of their antipathy towards Russia. But then as America went into the war against the Central Powers, that position was no longer attainable. But they wanted to see the fall of the Tsar. And they got that. Of course, you know, the Tsar just didn't fall. His entire family was massacred, you know, and there's some question who actually gave that order. You know, Lenin said it happened, but perhaps someone in London or New York made sure that was the case.
Yeah, Dr. Raphael Johnson has actually done some very interesting work on that and suggesting that there were some ritualistic aspects to that murder.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Anthony Sutton talked about why this was going on in Russia. You know, why would you had this odd situation of bankers in London and New York funding the Bolsheviks? And is this a? I interviewed Richard Spencer about that, and he followed the Anthony Sutton line, but the idea of Russia was kind of there. They wanted to destabilize Russia, because Russia, if it had been continued to develop, would have been a threat to the economic dominance of the. You know, the oligarchy, the oligarchs that ran the British Empire and the emerging American Empire. And if you destabilize Russia with a revolution, all its resources would either be able to be purchased on the cheap or just taken off the market for a while.
Right.
You know, and the Bolsheviks more or less were put in there to sort of destabilize Russia as proxy forces. But, you know, that's how New York and London perhaps saw figures like Trotsky and Lenin. To sort of destabilize Russia and also just create an arena for endless conflict. The type of thing we see, you know, maybe perhaps in Syria or in Libya and these things we see today.
And control of Eurasia has always been, I mean, at least, especially at that time, I can't remember when Mackinder's books came out. I believe, it must have been
back around 1900, yeah.
Yeah, it was early century. Yeah. But I mean, there was Eurasia has long been seen as a key geopolitical territory to hold, the world island.
Yeah, that's the Mackinder document. Is the control of the world's controlling the pivot.
Exactly.
Is Central Asia and these things. And if you control the island, your Eurasian island mass, landmass, you can control the world. And you can see the Mackinder Doctrine being played out not only in the First World War, but in the Second World War and the Cold War, because you look at NATO, well, NATO's job was to keep Germany down and Russia out, which is roughly the Mackinder Doctrine.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And we still see it today with what's going on with the neocons in Russia.
Yeah, it's remarkable how many different regimes Russia has gone through in the 20th century, yet for some reason it always seems to be at least for that brief time in the 30s and 40s, it seems to always be a problem for the Anglo-American elites.
And with the and what is interesting is in the post-war era, you have the interwar era, I guess now, from our perspective, is you have the Bolsheviks, which are largely run by Jews. It's largely a Jewish operation. And you also have the various revolutions going on throughout Hungary, short-lived, thankfully, but also in Germany with Kurt Eisner and the Bavarian. Mm-hmm. A lot of, distinctly Jewish agitation.
Yes.
Which standard historical treatments largely ignore that sort of, at least that pattern.
Not only do standard historical treatments ignore it, but one thing I've been encountering lately as I've been going back and reading through some of the old America First material is even the best among the people who I learned a lot from many years ago reading their works from that time, they tended to have a problem with it too. I wasn't really aware until very recently of the treatment of Donald Day by his boss at the Chicago Tribune.
Would that be McCormick?
McCormick,
mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, he was basically hung out to dry by Colonel McCormick. Donald Day wrote, he was a correspondent in the Baltic for many years, and he wrote it took a while for them to get published. I'm not exactly sure when they were finally published. I believe it was in the 1960s, but the initial publication was incomplete. It was his book, Onward Christian Soldiers. And he covered the conflict very honestly. And this apparently was a problem for people who I had grown to have some affection for, from people who I guess Justin Raimondo would call the old American right, which in many ways I think is a bit of a misnomer, or at least rather it's confusing. It is, I guess, historically accurate enough to call them the American right, but these people, they were liberals. I mean, they were old American liberals, people like John T. Flynn.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And John T. Flynn also objected to Lindbergh when Lindbergh famously described the three groups agitating for war. It was one of them was
the Roosevelt administration, the British and the Jews.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And John T. Flynn took exception to this when in reality, nothing that Lindbergh said was untrue.
No, it's the fact. I think it was Benjamin Ginsberg in his book, The Fatal Embrace, actually openly talks about how it was Jewish influence. It was pivotal in getting America into the Second World War, and they should be proud of it.
Yeah, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
But even back then, these were very popular writers, people like Flynn, a Chicago Tribune. I mean, Flynn was more well-known in his day than you mentioned Lippmann earlier, than Lippmann.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lippmann these days, I think, is better known than Flynn, but Flynn was a far more prominent writer in his day.
And I think another figure was the journalist Dorothy Thompson, mm-hmm. who also tried to disparage the America First as being anti-Semitic. And irony is, after the Second World War, she would be targeted by by Jewish organizations for being critical of Israel and the treatment of the Palestinians, and she would find herself out of a job, losing her column and her radio show, because she voiced criticism or concern about what was going on in 1948-49 in Israel.
That always seems to happen, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Poetic justice, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But it just it's one of these things where I think it's gotten worse since the Second World War, because the narrative of the Second World War. But even then, it was if you were to identify Jewish organizations as agitating or being involved in these things and advocating certain policies, you couldn't identify it as such. If you said, you know, the Jews, but you could always say the Germans or the Japanese or the Japs or the Krauts, but you couldn't say the Jews when talking about, you know, public policy or some sort of a political entity. I mean, there is a political entity called the Jews, and they do have organizations, and they do act collectively, and therefore they have to be criticized collectively in terms of just rhetoric, so we know what we're talking about.
Right, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, you were right. It was the British. I was just trying to find the exact quote. The British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration is what he said.
Mm-hmm. And that was September 11th, 1941?
It was September. I don't know if it was 11th.
Des Moines, Iowa speech.
If you remember it as such, it probably is.
Yeah, the Des Moines, Iowa speech.
Yeah, it was 1941 in September. Yeah.
Well, that's one thing that they try to disparage America First. Obviously, we're shooting ahead to the 1940-41 period, when the Roosevelt administration really started to ramp up its efforts to drag a country into the Second World War, which was then raging. I think what happened was you had the fall of France in the summer of 1940, and all of a sudden we were fed this idea of a crisis, that America was threatened. Looking back, it's kind of ridiculous if you just look at a map and any idea of geography. Really, that critical period, 1940-41, after 1940, it was clear that England wouldn't be overrun. Germany never had the capacity or the desire to invade. But nevertheless, Roosevelt was giving speeches about Germany invading South America via, you know, Dakar, Southwest Africa. And yeah, somehow they're going to find their way up to Central America and Mexico and invade Texas. I don't know. But making these ridiculous claims, exaggerated claims about the threat that Germany posed against the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, well, that is, of course, why it was necessary to have Pearl Harbor at all in order to justify. I mean, American public was completely opposed to the war. In fact, Roosevelt himself campaigned against foreign entanglements. But yeah, it turns on a dime.
As did Woodrow Wilson in 1916.
As did George W. Bush in the current years.
Mothers, your sons will not be sent on foreign shores to fight, as he promised.
Yeah, it's almost like sending your kids to go die in foreign countries is an immensely unpopular policy proposal.
And yeah, and then when they do it and you criticize it, then you have to support the troops.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, even Lindbergh himself basically caved after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, yeah, America First folded, and in fact, they were shut down by the FBI, more or less. Yeah. Regnery talked about the FBI came and took his mailing list and never got it back, and that was it. It was shut down. Although you could look at it, Pearl Harbor seemed to vindicate them. Of course, the intrigues of Pearl Harbor is, you know, obviously. What's out now is the Roosevelt administration not only did everything they could to provoke it, they knew about it, and they sacrificed 2,100 American lives to gain entry into his backdoor to war, because he hadn't been able to provoke the Germans in the Atlantic, and he had declared more or less war against Germany already illegally in the so-called Battle of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was. I mean, whether or not you accept, say, Daniel Dennett. Is that the name? Mm-hmm. No, Daniel. He's the cognitive philosopher, Stinnett.
Stinnett. Yeah, his book. Yeah,
yeah. Whether or not you accept his thesis, it doesn't really matter, because, as you mentioned, the United States did everything it could to provoke the war through oil and steel embargoes, and they moved the Pacific Fleet there as sitting ducks,
mm-hmm.
as they're provoking Japan. So to what degree the Roosevelt administration was following along with the actual operation to make sure that those ships got hit, I'm perfectly happy to sign off on that. I found him to be very persuasive, and others I've read as well. But you don't even need that. It doesn't matter. I mean, they orchestrated this regardless.
Yeah, and you had in 1941, you had like the Greer incident where the ship was communicating, with airplanes and communicating to the British, had a fire on German submarine out in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere. And then you had the convoying. But even American First, when I talked about the first, there was cash and carry, which some of them supported, actually. It said cash and carry, and then it became lend-lease, all age, short of war, and then became convoying. and all these, this just unfolded. Now, of course, even in the Roosevelt administration was full of Zionists and Jews. You had, Morgenthau, who was involving himself in foreign policy, even who was Secretary of the Treasury.
Bernard Baruch,
who was a big figure in the First World War. I mean, the War Industries Board became sort of the head of the U.S. economy and became enriched in that position, him and his friends. Came from nowhere, by the way. Decided, he all of a sudden he was able to inveigle himself, and he's given this position of War Industries Board, and then he becomes this oligarch. But yeah, he's consulting in the FDR administration, and I think it was Ben Cohen who wrote the lend-lease bill.
Yep. When you had Harry Hopkins, of course.
Yeah, I think his wife was Jewish.
Yeah, and he was effectively a communist agent.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So you had all these agents. Dexter White was. I think he was a communist. He was Jewish too, right?
It's debated, but yeah, I mean, he was a communist. That's not to be debated.
Yeah.
Whether he's a Jew is another question.
And so you had all these foreign interests, not to mention the influence of the British. I mean, you had, obviously you had William Stevenson, Intrepid, his operations over there on Rockefeller Center, given rent-free office space. And you had Roald Dahl and these people coming in. They were kind of, his job was, apparently he reportedly had an affair with what's her name? Claire Booth Luce.
Yeah, did you get that from Thomas Maul's book?
I got that from the book The Irregulars. But okay. I have read Thomas Maul's book too about there's sort of using sex, even murder, bribery, blackmail, and these things. Senator Vandenberg, who was a critical of interventionism, I believe had a British sweetheart, girlfriend. Who's having an affair with and these things. So this is how policy is made.
Yeah, I think you can't overstate how unpopular this was. I mean, America First, I believe at its peak, had around 800,000 members.
Mm-hmm. Yep. In opposition effort to enter the wars, it was anywhere between 79 and 90%.
Oh, yeah.
That's how unpopular it was. And even FDR's supporters claimed where he had to go against popular opinion and do these things because he just knew better than everyone else, but there was never there's and you had this extensive British spy network operating, suborning the U.S. government, getting espionage and these things. You wonder how this is so. Well, it's very similar to now, as you had a government, same way the government today doesn't have much, so we say, desire to investigate Israeli espionage. The same thing was occurring in the 1940-41 period, whereas the federal government was so infiltrated, it was working with it, security, was it British security, what's it called again? Something. Security coordination. British security and coordination, I think it was called. But you wonder why there's no investigations. That's because the Roosevelt administration had no desire to uproot or investigate or do away with this foreign government, which had suborned the U.S. government, bent it to its interest. Because
one of the great ironies here, I mean, you had, by the 1950s, you had the Soviet Union taking Zionist espionage more seriously than the United States when they hung those 11 men in, was it Prague?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The crack, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was a country that, as you mentioned, Tim, was created by Jewish revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then come the 1950s, they're executing Zionists. And, I mean, also at that time, that's when they suddenly become an enemy of the United States after being their great ally through the European War.
Yes.
I wonder if there's a coincidence there.
And the OSS and CIA are bringing in Nazis
right.
to fight the Cold War and do other things. And yeah, and that's, you know, because that's your going that might stem from the Trotsky-Stalin split. Yeah, and how the, you know, the Trotskyites became, you know, eventually would become neoconservatives, but they're the ones that I guess took up the cause against, you know, Stalin, at least here in the United States. But one of the ironies was is that we're talking about America First in opposition to American entry into the Second World War. One of the criticisms is they were called, you know, pro-Nazi or communist, because up until June 22nd, 1941, the official position of the Communist Party of the United States was opposition to American entry into the war because of the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact that was still in play up until, like I said, June 22nd, 1941. So if you didn't support going to war against Hitler, you were pro-Hitler. That was sort of the argument. Well, it's kind of funny because the moment that Germany invades Russia in 1941, all of a sudden the Communist Party supports American entry into the war, then American First could come out and say, well, look at this.
yeah, right. I mean, prior to that, the communists during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, communists around the Western world were in favor of neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And this was run largely by the Munzenberg Network. These people took direct cues. I mean, they had their agents in place to decide when that happened. It wasn't just an organic decision on part of all good, well-meaning communists everywhere who finally, well, they've been, you know, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, therefore we're against it. I mean, they were taking cues from the international.
Yes. And he was involved also like in Hollywood and things like that.
Hollywood and in the literati circles in London and in New York City.
And in the run-up to the war in 1940-41, you also had Hollywood that was enlisted in the cause. Because you had all these movies coming out about how good the British are and how bad the Germans are.
Yeah, you know that Disney was actually taken over by U.S. military?
Yeah, I don't think they ever left.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if Walt was alive today to see what had become of his creations, I mean, he would probably kill himself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Disney was taken over, but you have people, you know, people like Jack Warner saying, you know, this is before America's entry into the war, is that he was saying, well, I'm enlisted in this cause. So, I mean, think about movies like Casablanca or Mission to Moscow and these things. Even Casablanca, which I think came out in 1942, it's kind of funny because you think about it. If it came out in 1942, it had to be being made in 1941.
Right, exactly.
So
yeah, there was. I'm trying to remember the story behind Casablanca. It was Julius Epstein. Yeah, that's right. Okay, it was Julius Epstein who wrote the screenplay. That makes sense. Yeah,
and it was about, you know, obviously Rick, who wants to stay uninvolved, but he's compelled to get involved. So that's the message of that war.
Yeah, the when the Epsteins, because it was Julius Epstein and his brother, when they were asked on a HUAC questionnaire if they were members of a subversive organization, they responded, "Yes, Warner Brothers."
That's funny. In 1940, the new media as it existed then was primarily print, radio, and of course the movies. But even then, you could say that the media was largely Jewish run. Newspapers were largely Jewish, particularly outfits like the New York Times and the Washington Post, of course, two major newspapers. The difference perhaps might have been Chicago, I guess, the Tribune.
Yeah, and, Chicago
and
Tribune. Hearst
papers,
would be the example, and I guess the. Had the Dearborn folded by that time? I suppose it had.
Well, Ford's paper, yeah.
Yeah. The Dearborn Independent was what it was called. Yeah, no, the Chicago Tribune was probably one of the leading lights as far as opposition to the war. But you had, I mean, John T. Flynn was writing for the New Republic still at the time, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it was in 1940 or 41, the Chicago Tribune issued a leaked war plan, which called for mobilization of 10 million men, America's entry into the war in Europe and Asia. And this was a war plan that, of course, became reality a year later. So he was leaking these things. I think it was Colonel McCormick who, I think in 1945, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, was accused of not being too upset about it.
Yeah.
And someone said that his newspaper outside the building, they didn't have the flag at half mast in recognition of the president's death. And his response was, I can't think of anyone I'd like to hang the flag half mast more than for Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
You know, I was like, no, I'm perfectly happy to do that. You know, the motion picture industry, it started around 1937, but you had movies like, what was it? Some of these movies coming out, where it's like Confessions of a Nazi Spy, Beast of Berlin.
Yes. Yeah, I remember Confessions of a Nazi Spy, Beast of Berlin. I'm not familiar with.
Hitchcock's Correspondent, Christopher's Charlie Chaplin, The Great Dictator. But even things like Gunga Din, right, or Sergeant York, who just happened to win Best Picture in 1941. Surprise, surprise. About, you know, a reluctant warrior going off to war and becoming great at war. So these movies are picked for a reason. Just like I think it was in 1947 or 48 that A Gentleman's Agreement was Best Picture, which is about anti-Semitism.
Huh.
Gregory.
Yeah, Peck. I didn't. You had also Fritz Lang, I believe, was in Hollywood by this time. I think he was in Hollywood by 36. He did a couple war films as well.
Mm-hmm. And so you see the complex operating here, right? Media, entertainment, you know, these things. And so people are being prepped for this. This isn't, despite all this, you still have opposition to the war at around 80-85%. You know?
Yeah, far better than today. And I think what's the main contrast between then and now is you had members of the American cultural elite who were worth something, who had respect among the people. You know, I mean, Lindbergh was a hero, was the national hero.
Yeah.
Up until September 11th, 1941.
That's right. And you had people like, a good example is the American First Committee, or sort of this, although I think it started at Yale, of all places, Yale Law School, but its real power was the Midwest. And this represented how America, even at this point, was still largely decentralized. And there was a Midwest with a separate interest. It saw itself with at least separate or competing interest than that of Wall Street. This was the area of agriculture and industrial production, not finance.
And you had a lot of Germans there too. And
yeah.
These were people who still understood themselves to be a part of European civilization.
Well, that's maybe something we should talk about the war. Was it a war against Europe? And why was Europe targeted? America was used. The Brave New World, America. The New Atlantis was used as the arsenal of democracy to smash Europe.
The Golem.
Yeah, which is very interesting.
Nowadays, you just don't have that level of support among, you know, normal people. It's like the left, in the opposition to the Bush wars, you had a lot of, you know, far left types who just hated what they thought George Bush represented. But as we saw with the Obama regime that followed shortly after that, these people had no principled opposition to the American war machine, because as we know, Obama carried on the Bush policies.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But back then you had normal people, they understood this stuff.
Yeah, Lindbergh talked about defending our European heritage, right?
Yes, yes.
Which is funny because, you know, it's America. America's supposed to be a break from Europe. But, you know, there's some consciousness, there's sort of this ethnic consciousness which defined America, where there were specific ethnic groups within America tracing their lineage back to Europe and knowing that, you know, obviously the war would mean their sons going off to make war on cousins.
Exactly. Exactly right. Mm.
And you don't get that anymore. You don't get that identity. First, as American, who's increasingly non-European, which is becomes a political and a demographic problem. I think the people, the war planners knew this because war is a huge social engineering undertaking. The war itself, the war mobilization, and people like John T. Flynn foresaw this perpetual debt in these things. He didn't exactly know how it would play out because he predicted, calamity and impoverishment, when actually what brought in was America's post-war boom brought about, by America's economic primacy, largely a product of the war. But you could buy off a couple generations with consumerism and turn them into what Americans are today, right? I mean...
Yeah, this is my – again, I mentioned earlier that these people, if you read a lot of great writers like Justin Raimondo, they reference these people a lot. But at the end of the day, I think people like Flynn, though both a talented writer and a well-meaning guy in terms of, he wanted peace. He did not want war. At the same time, being a liberal himself, I don't think he was really – able to understand exactly what the true enemy here was. Mm-hmm. Hence why the libertarians and to a certain extent the paleocons go to great lengths to distinguish capitalism, some platonic ideal of capitalism, from crony capitalism. Yet I'm not exactly sure where in history you could point to a situation of these mythical free markets totally divorced from political power.
Well, it's not that capitalism has failed, it just hasn't been tried yet.
They really do, man. They really have more in common with the communists than they're ever going to admit.
And that's a difficult pill to swallow, and it's also a difficult thing to understand if you're stuck in the rhetoric and the political dichotomy that we're given, right versus left, socialism versus communism. At the end of the day, they're both materialistic doctrines, which end in the same, same destination.
Right, exactly.
And a lot of that is, there was some criticism of Joseph Nye's criticism of America First, that the America First fancies itself as a free market, outfit, and these things are meaning that the war being the end of the free market, and that's largely, obviously war planning does that, that's true. But really, the war itself was the rise of the corporation. I think during the war, $40 billion was given to corporations to refit their factories and these things. So it's a huge wealth transfer scheme going on, not to mention the fact that after the war, you had the creation of the interstate highway system and these things, infrastructure and these things, which largely is thought of as good, but it also was a huge social engineering thing and a huge subsidy to those industries, not to mention the automobile industry and these things would benefit from that. Airline travel itself was developed largely because of the Second World War. Aviation has never been a free market operation, the idea that there was this liberal outlook of things, and this is perhaps why John T. Flynn and many other people had a difficult identifying the ethnic component to the causes of the war, namely a Jewish agitation.
Exactly.
And
those were my two main points.
Yeah.
Yeah. The you got it. You got it, Tim.
And I think it was Rabbi Stephen Wise was asked about his activism, and did Sam Dixon say this on your show? Or was it someone else's show? Might have been someone else's show. I think it was Sam Dixon who relayed this quote. He goes, "I've been an American for 200 years, and I've been a Jew for 3,000 years."
Yeah, rather. No, that wasn't my show, but that's a good quote.
Okay. Now, his point was, okay, that's fine for them to think that way, but other people perhaps should have the same thoughts. And then we can hash it out, right? Because then we can respect everyone.
Reminds me of the inverse of what Richard Nixon said in one of his tapes, which is, "I said, God damn it, you got to be a American first and a Jew second."
But that's not going to happen. I mean, it hasn't happened.
No, it will not happen.
In fact, they openly say it doesn't happen.
No, and now what an American is more like a Jew. So if anything, the Americans have assimilated to the Jew rather than the other way around.
Well, that's the cultural along with the political and cultural conquest, and people ain't even identifying that. But the thing is, the ultimate conquest is the people who don't realize it, right? I mean, that's the mental conquest of the people.
The cultural, political, and religious conquest as well, through, of course, Christian Zionism.
Mm-hmm. That's Samuel Untermeyer, that's the early part of the 20th century, leading up to the Zionist project. This is a plan that's laid out.
And the Scofield Bible.
Yeah, the Scofield Bible. But of course, the Second World War, you have the narrative of the Holocaust, the so-called Final Solution. And this is sort of, I think, represents the sort of the... Well, the coup de grace, so to speak, or perhaps, which everyday people are going to be denied the right or to criticize Jewish activism or power for fear of being accused of being a Nazi and bringing on perhaps being a stalking horse, bringing on perhaps another pogrom or Holocaust, and this destroys the capacity of people in the West to proffer constructive and necessary criticism of various Jewish organizations.
Yeah, the Holocaust myth is really, at this point, the cornerstone of the American religion.
Yeah, it's a justification for everything, right?
Yeah, It explains the war in these moralistic terms, and it provides, ongoing further justification. I mean, the Holocaust will always be invoked. Who was it at the Republican debates? It was one of the Jewish question askers who asked about Aleppo. Isn't what's going on in Aleppo, isn't it like another Holocaust? You know, I mean, this is... It provides it's the argumentum ad Hitlerum.
It reaches its absurdity in the 2016 primaries when they're having the Republican debates. This is when they had 17 candidates up there.
Yes, that's what I was referring to. Yes,
and there was a question. I remember this, and if I'm misremembering it, I apologize. But I do think someone asked a question: is would you have killed Hitler when he was a baby?
Oh, really? I missed that one.
And they're actually talking about this seriously. I mean, that's how absurd it got. I'm like,
After all of this, after this 20th century of just 100 years of slaughter, and it's like, the only thing you should have learned from this is the Holocaust.
And the fact that killing a baby is justified. Which again is the 20th century right there, isn't it? Killing babies can be justified.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, we're definitely at that point.
Yes, yes. But I was thinking, wait a second, if you can go back in time and intervene and change history for the better, how about, I don't know, if Hitler really is the pivot of history, how about go back in history and make him accepted into art school, something less. Right? I mean, come on. Prevent the arch, tell Archduke Ferdinand not to go down that, not to go out that day. Just so many things.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, I'm thinking, why would you, get this? Hey, let's find a way just by killing a baby.
Because no matter what, the Jewish revenge imperative has to be fulfilled. And
yes,
you can't fulfill that without blood.
And that's like the concept. It wasn't so much the First World War, the peace, the consequences of the peace, the great inflation and the turmoil in Germany, which led to the rise of Hitler. It's just Hitler existing at all, right? Because if you put Hitler in any other context, he's going to come to power. Like in Boys of Brazil, right? You can just raise these...
Right, yeah, right.
Exactly. You can put someone who's a clone of Hitler in 1978
You push
context.
His dad down the stairs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he's going to come to power somehow. It's like... So, the European, these wars in Europe, I guess you can look at, people have looked at the both world wars as sort of a 30 years war, a second 30 years war, which I think is apropos because the first 30 years war resulted in sort of the destruction of Germany, or at least the retardation of German development in these things. These conflicts and the effect it had on European civilization, and also the effect it had on the United States in its relationship to Europe, not only just diplomatic or economic, but also its cultural links to Europe. Because you cannot have the destruction of these cities like Dresden and these things, and not to mention the depopulation and the demoralization that's occurring. And the
forced starvation of 2 million Germans.
Yes.
Eisenhower.
Under Eisenhower, the Rhine-Meadow camps, that operation, which is sort of like a Morgenthau plan implemented.
I mean, and how many Americans know about this? I mean, it's just, it's remarkable.
Patton was
absolutely incredulous at this, which mm-hmm. is why I do believe he was probably killed, because he became a big problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was observing what was going on and the various Jewish torturers rampaging through Germany and murdering and brutalizing people.
Yeah, people don't realize how many the Germans were interrogated and tortured by Jewish interrogators at Nuremberg and other trials.
The Nuremberg farce.
And so when we hear about stories about atrocities, none of the evidence could be put forth in a legitimate court.
Or even what America did in Japan, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, firebombing of Tokyo, for instance.
Yep, in March 1945. And apparently, was it Henry Hap Arnold, who I think it was in between the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. I think it was after Nagasaki, he mustered a 1,000-plane raid on Tokyo just to see if he can get 1,000 planes into the air at once. That was kind of like a threshold or something.
Typical American behavior.
And thinking, wait, I mean, and this is when Japan is, already suing for peace. And none of this is talked about. Well, it's war, so it's okay.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. If you're going to say, well, it's war, it's okay, then why the legal farce at Nuremberg?
Yeah, it was war, right?
Yeah, it's war, right? So why don't you just, you're going to execute him? Why the pretense of this being a criminal trial and you serving justice? I mean, it's fundamentally anti-European. I mean, not just the fact of waging war against Europe, but the British did start this at Versailles, but it was a break from the conventions of how war was conducted in Europe.
Mm-hmm. The idea that you put people up for trial and these things, and there was scarcely a crime, that Nazi Germany had committed that wasn't committed by the other side. I mean,
that you make the civilian population pay for the alleged crimes of their elites.
They're still paying for it.
Still to this day, yes.
It's like, really? There's so many survivors of this program that annihilate. Yeah. Well, I guess if you offer payment, that's going to happen.
Right, exactly. It'll suck you dry, man.
So, but what you had with both wars, it just destroyed Europe and it put it under, Anglo-American domination. Obviously, that's obvious with NATO and these things. And you got this dialectic of the Cold War, right? I mean, if World War II, what do you make of this Cold War?
Well, the Cold War, we're talking about how you did have a sizable portion of the cultural elite, the non-Jewish cultural mm-hmm. elite in America who were against this. Well, the Cold War, really what it did is it co-opted what was left of what you would, I guess, call the old American right. It's a little bit funny to me to call them the right because you did have a contrast. The real right wing amongst them were a minority compared to general just American liberals of the old variety, normal people who imbibed the ideological zeitgeist of their day.
Mm-hmm.
But that, by the time of the Cold War and by the ascendancy of people like William F. Buckley, I mean, that and the John Birch Society played a major role in this too,
mm-hmm.
of co-opting the sensibilities of normal people, 20 years too late against communism.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it was, I think Buckley's job was sort of there to corral and civilize, housebreak what remained of the right into the Cold War. agenda, which at the time was sort of a Truman, there's a Democratic program, but the Republicans picked up the mantle. There was some skepticism, significant skepticism, people like Robert Taft and these things about the Cold War agenda. But crises came about, you know, like Korea, which no one could have seen, right? Korea saved us.
Yeah, and they became, and the right suddenly becomes these people seeking world revolution all over the globe.
Democracy, yeah. Yeah. Democratic revolution. And America, again, it's all part of this proposition nation thing, getting back to what America is it's a proposition nation. So if you disagree with that proposition, you're not an American. Whereas if it were an ethnic state, you'd be a member of the family no matter what you believed. It'd be almost
right,
like
exactly.
Thanksgiving Day dinner. You can have this political discussion, yelling at each other. And the argument is over. You can sit back and say, throwing I love turkey. You, man. You're my brother. Give me some turkey, right? Because you got this bond. But if it's all ideas, if you've known people who get subsumed by ideas and they alienate themselves from their families because of these things, and they lose priorities in these things, people on both sides get this attitude. Is don't let ideas get in the way of kin and blood and you know, because that's what really ties, you know, these are the ties that bind.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of sort of the, I think, getting back to sort of the liberal lie, right, where we can rely on just ideas and concepts, and this is the proposition.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And Buckley played his hand in it in a major way. This is likely had CIA backing to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think at the time of Congress Cultural Freedom and all this funding of magazines and, you know, he can't really say where he got the money from and these things. And he was, I'm sorry, Buckley was CIA. Or, you know, right? He worked for, you know, Howard Hunt in Mexico.
Yes. And yes, he did. Yeah.
So how do you look at it and go, So.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And then you mentioned earlier, Tim, the Trotskyites coming in as well. You know, people like Irving Kristol.
Yeah, it's particularly after 1967 when the Jews embrace Zionism openly in the United States and the ascendancy of Jewish power in the 70s and sort of the waning of the WASP elite.
And what was necessary for that was what I had mentioned prior, which was the turning of the USSR against Zionism and against Jewry.
Yeah. And that's what was it, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment in 1974. And Jews get special treatment out of Russia. They get to leave Russia.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
which is why any time you meet anyone who says that their family came from Russia between, like, you know, 1960 and the mid-90s, like, they're 10 out of 10 times a Jew.
Yeah, and then also, when I talk about Russian mafia, you're 9 out of 10 times they're Jewish, right?
Oh, yeah. There was I don't know if you saw the film a few years back made by a Jew, body horror filmmaker of David Cronenberg.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Promises.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as you might remember in that film, it portrays the Russian mob as being a Christian mob.
Yes.
An Orthodox Christian mob.
And it's all states, you know, because it was a Russian. The Jewish Russians that were played a big part in the raping of Russia in the 90s, working with, you know, such, you know, guys like Jeffrey Sachs and Larry Summers,
yes.
Who are what?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then, you know, again, then Putin put the kibosh, so to speak, on that.
Yeah. And which was now one of the reasons why Putin now is now a target, or Russia is a target of the neocons.
Right. It continues.
And this
funny,
yeah,
go ahead.
And this world revolution stuff never stops. I mean, look at Victoria Nuland in the Ukraine.
Right. And as we see that may be heating up too.
Yeah. And then now they're doing this intrigue with the church there, within the Orthodox Church, where they're trying to declare independence from the Russian church. And this is the Greek, Orthodox Church, which is largely controlled, you know, by the West, because they're dependent upon the Greek diaspora and West, and also the World Council of Churches and funding and these things through the, I guess the church in Constantinople, And so you get this intrigue of trying to, again, create more further division within this area. You know.
Yeah, I think people underestimate, too, how influential the John Birch Society was at the time.
But that was the only voice for, like, outside the, you know, sort of the standard political, you know, the sort of Republican versus Democrat thing. But, yeah, they seem to miss the mark on a lot of things.
Well, they'd miss the mark. I mean, Robert Welch made sure that they missed the mark. I mean, they had, if you read accounts of people who understood what was going on but were wrapped up, people like Revel P. Oliver, talk about the dynamics at play there where, yes, they were the only ones, and they were distributing decent enough literature. I mean, they had bookstores all over the country, and that's where you would go to be able to find some material on communism, for instance. It's not something that you would find elsewhere. But, of course, it was all sanitized and made kosher. And people who discussed the Jewish element were purged.
Yeah, as is usual the case, yeah. You'll get what they call dynamic silence, where you just find yourself sort of unemployed.
Yeah, you find yourself unemployed, exactly.
Yeah. And also, or you know, so a lot of well-meaning people. I'm thinking people like Phyllis Schlafly, right?
Yeah.
Who ended up being used and abused by the Republican Party her entire life, despite her, you know, her activism. She single-handedly stopped the Equal Rights Amendment, really. But at the end of the day, it was ERA has been implemented by Ruth Bader Ginsburg being appointed to the court. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter.
And it allowed for that the Cold War dialectic you mentioned, because again they came to the anti-communism a bit too late.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you square that? And that's why there were a lot of dissidents who were sort of created in that milieu, because, you know, they're like, okay, we're hardcore anti-communist now. That's great. Like, you know, we don't like communism. And then it's like, hey, wait a second. Why did the U.S. side with the Soviet Union against Germany? Can anyone explain that? And it's like, you're out of here, guy.
Yeah, you have Roosevelt talking about religious freedom. It's the Christian nations versus the pagan, you know, the totalitarian dictatorship. Wait a second.
And also the economic dialectic component, too. You know, it's a way of propping up the ideological capitalism, too.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the right became,
for lack of a better term, retarded. I mean, that, like, that's basically the common myth on the right. And this is my least favorite aspect. Like I said, the paleocons and some of the more old school libertarians, they did a good job keeping some of this material alive. I mean, that's certainly how I ran into it. I wouldn't have ever come across John T. Flynn otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, they tend to paint communism as the deaths that occurred in Russia were the result of economic planning.
Oh, I mean, as opposed to
to sadism.
Yeah.
I mean, they leave out, when you leave out the, you know, what Solzhenitsyn would describe in books like 200 Years Together,
mm-hmm.
You really can't understand it exactly.
Or what's going on in the Ukraine, yeah, in the 30s.
Yes.
Yeah.
With forced starvation, yeah.
Forced starvation, these things. Meaning that it wasn't just, yeah, failure to plan or just missteps. And
no, it was an ancient ethnic animus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the American right never really came to understand what communism was.
Well, that's the same with cultural Marxism, how it was imported by the OSS and CIA and promoted by the establishment in the United States, the American Jewish Committee, working with CIA and MKUltra to wage the cultural war and psychological warfare of the post-war era. Free love and these things being promoted, by the American Jewish Committee to wage war on the family. And this is, again, at the same time, this is being promoted by the federal government through funding of Planned Parenthood. And much of the confusion, family breakup, and sexual, confusion and degeneracy we're seeing today was planned out. You know,
and it works, too, because you can find some good old boys who are going to talk about how much they hate communism, but, you know, they're all right with, you know, homosexual marriage and...
Or Hugh Hefner, right?
Yeah, or Hugh Hefner. Yeah,
exactly. Which probably had CIA funding, too, for his magazine. So, obviously, if Kinsey got funding, you know, from the Ford Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation, same time that someone like Hefner has been getting all this funding, you know, from banks for his publications and these things to promote the Playboy culture. At the same time, feminism is being created by the CIA, Gloria Steinem, CIA agent.
And the irony is these people would have been executed in the USSR.
Yes, that's funny. That's right. That's right. But it sort of like, you know, people point out the, like the American Jewish Committee, the book on the authoritarian personality. People say, well, it was a reaction because of the Second World War. Well, that's funny because that agenda that they spell out in the authoritarian personality was implemented before the Second World War in Hungary. You know, and it was implemented, you know, Wilhelm Reich, he was spewing his ideas in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, in the Weimar
period. In the Weimar period. So, and you know, look what was going on in the Weimar period. You know, people forget that, it's obvious whatever National Socialism was, it was a reaction to something. And there's always a reaction to something. And then it's the reaction that gets all the attention and not the action or the provocative behavior.
Yeah, the American right did not understand the degree to which their enemies were, you know, inside of America, mm-hmm. their true enemies. There's somewhat of a political naivete, and there was also, I think, a lot of cowardice on behalf of the more prominent people to not want to go there because they wanted to, you know, they wanted peace and they didn't want American intervention, but they also wanted to remain, you know, respectable.
Yeah. And there was, remember, in the early part of the 20th century, you know, I don't know, there was at least an acknowledgement that there was indeed a question, right?
Right, of course.
And so at least with that acknowledgement, you can engage in some sort of dialogue and hopefully, you know, maintain the peace and maintain the culture. But when you fail to recognize that there is a problem or a question, whether it's in the movies, I'm talking about the so-called Jewish question, you no longer have the grammar that you can engage in some sort of dialogue. And perhaps, you know, avoid a calamity. Right now, that, you know, there's so much chutzpah out there now because we're not even given the language to articulate an argument. We're denied that. And
there was also a clearer conception of community back then, of ethnic religious mm-hmm. community, where you come from, which is a necessary condition to understand when something is alien.
Which was intentionally broken up.
Exactly, because That is the key to being able to identify and to act politically against subversive alien groups that mean to destroy what is important to you.
Yeah, there was
the civilization.
An account in I think a figure we can all kind of relate to is Pat Buchanan, where Pat Buchanan, I think, knows more than he lets on about what's really going on.
Oh, big time.
You know? But he's in the scene, right? So he can't, although as he's ends, you know.
He's getting older, though, he's letting yes. slip a little bit more yeah. and more.
And, well, here's the thing. In his book, right from the beginning, there's an account where his brothers went out and they busted up like a news tent that was selling pornography.
Oh, that's awesome. Is that his biography? I haven't read that.
Right from the beginning.
I got to read that. That's
About 30 years old. He wrote it in the late 80s, early 90s. That requires not only moral clarity, but an ethnic consciousness to back up that moral clarity.
Right.
And also not to care about what, you know, about the law or what the law is, because the law has actually become a weapon. So in some cases, you can't use it for your protection. It's actually is being used against you. But sort of,
and
like
if the law was at a time, if it was drawn out of, I mean, the history of police in America has never been a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you would have local cops who are
yeah.
of your community. And if you go around, you know, torching porno stands, they're going to I don't know, maybe buy you a beer later.
Exactly, yeah. So there's the moral order, right? There's no progress outside the moral order. So within that moral order, so you have an anomaly of a law that maybe isn't consistent with the moral order, or the moral order wins out. And who cannot cheer the idea of, you know, a couple of, you know, local guys going in and chasing out a pornographer? You know, him crying First Amendment. What the hell with that?
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
You know. Yeah, go get a lawyer. See what happens. You know, but that is, see, the community requires ethnic consciousness for that to happen.
Yes, you know, it does.
That's not going to occur in suburbia, right? That's not...
No, suburbia is designed to prevent that.
Yeah, there's, you know, everyone's in their house watching TV. You know, then no one's going to care about that, and it's going to be stuff that crap's going to be sold at the mall anyway, where everyone trucks to, you know, goes to. To buy things, so that's you know, that gives you an example, you know, how you know the community was maintained informally and much more efficiently than, you know, than could be do otherwise, or what's done today. But that type of America was destroyed. You know, that gives the whole, at least domestically, what occurred in the United States was this sort of this collectivization and sort of this reorganization of American society for the purposes of the war effort in the American century and ultimately the Cold War. You have this mass, and I think you had talked about it when I was on your show, just talk about, you know, what happened with the cities, with bringing up the blacks from the South, going to the cities. This began in World War One, but really World War Two really kicked in and just was used to disrupt the ethnic neighborhoods. And then following the war, you have the suburbia interstate highway system. At the same time, mass communication is being developed. And with entertainment and these things, and then by that point, everyone's off in suburbia, imbibing pop culture, entertainment, and they've become completely deracinated, and they can easily be manipulated and ruled at that point.
Which leads me to maybe we can go back and forth on this question for the finale here. Mm-hmm. It leads me to the question that if in the 1930s, when you had an America that was more cohesive, and you had cultural elites who weren't, you know, smut peddlers and culture distorters, mm-hmm. who were genuine cultural elites who deserved their place in society and deserved to be respected and deserved to be listened to. When you had 800,000 Americans who understood that a European war, an American involvement in a European war, was both against the American national interest, and some understood as well that is against European civilization itself, something that Americans should belong to, despite coming from a long line of rejecting it. They should be a part of it on some level. If back then that failed, the best that we could have come up with in a time in which we had a far more cohesive and culturally and spiritually healthy society, what hope do we have now?
I think the hope, it doesn't, I think hope lies in what may come from it.
I'm not going to say that there's no hope for the future at all. Yeah. I would never say that. But what I would say is I am pretty bleak about an American mass movement.
I'd have to agree with you there. I think the hope is in some sort of decentralized approach. I think the American state sort of decomposing and changing and sort of, I don't know, sort of this peaceful decomposition, if that's at all possible, it becomes decentralized and its constituent parts realize that they have more value than being part of this huge union, and, you know, would be a better route to go. Obviously, there's not going to be a mass American movement for these things, because the centralization that would be required for a mass movement is completely mobilized against such a thing. That is the enemy. So you're right. I don't think you can have a nationwide effort to bring about some sort of revitalization, some sort of American renaissance, if you will.
And the liberals themselves, there's no real liberals left who are in the least bit sane or restrained in their desire to impose their worldview on the rest of the world.
No, they're mad Jacobins or something. It's, yeah, they want to force everything down everyone's throat. Everything, I mean. and you see it with sort of, I think the reduction ad absurdum of the liberal world order is sort of what they call global homo.
Global homo, yeah.
It's a global homo agenda, and that's, I mean, now it's like everywhere you You turn or look on something as something promoting some sort of sexual degenerate behavior as normal or something to be promoted. If you're not sufficiently enthusiastic about it, you're hateful.
Yeah, and far more destructive. It is, and it's more powerful too because of its flawless union with money, power, and capital. It is ultimately more destructive than communism.
It is
proved to be.
It's revolutionary. It really is revolutionary.
It's more revolutionary. I mean, throughout the Cold War, the liberal power, the United States, was far more invested in revolutions in other countries than the USSR was.
Yeah, from the get-go. And that's the irony of the Cold War, isn't it? Is it who was upending regimes? Because really, if you look at the Cold War, once you had the contours of the Cold War laid out, in the post-war settlement, Germany's unconditional surrender and you have the Warsaw Pact, it's pretty solid, pretty stable. I mean, those lines never changed. And the irony is the final analysis is it was the Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain, which ended up, although as bad as communism was, it culturally protected those countries from the toxic West. And we see it today where signs of life are occurring in Eastern Europe. Poland or in Hungary, even Russia, these places with a sense of ethnic identity, nationhood, and these things, conservatism, traditional societies, which is why now we see NATO hell-bent with Jews at the forefront, Victoria Nuland, the Kagans and these things, working to undermine these societies through NGOs and these things, through weaponized migration. These organizations that are funded to transport hundreds of thousands of, or if not millions of refugees into European states. How did 80,000 Somalis end up in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Did they walk? And to support, of course, culture distortions, culture subversions in the form of hip-hop music, pornography, etc.
And that's what the military is doing, right? The military is used to kind of export this crap.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like the worst... the irony is that these people were protected from it. Now, at least in Poland, there's some ethnic identity in Poland. It's ethnic Catholic identity. Ian Michael Jones was talking about how he went there and he was able to give a speech and not get shut down. We couldn't have done that in the United States. The Catholic Church would have shut him down.
Ian Michael Jones was able to give a speech in Tehran.
I know.
They'd probably hire him there at one of their universities.
Well, and unlike our diplomats, he's not a member of the CIA, nor is he promoting, handing cookies out to revolutionaries like Victoria Nuland, right?
Right.
Wasn't Victoria Nuland, she technically a diplomat?
She is technically a diplomat, yes.
Yeah, she says F the EU.
F the EU, Nuland, yeah.
Yeah, so the only diplomats are kind of these unofficial characters, like Ian Michael Jones, who travels and gives us a talk there, and they realize not every American's insane or something.
Yeah. Those are the kind of people who used to become diplomats in healthy European societies.
Well, now they're all like intelligence assets and these things,
right? Of course.
It's like now it's just taken. By the way, it's taking it for granted that the American embassy would have like a CIA office operating out of it. Isn't that a violation? The whole idea of an embassy.
Yeah, American embassies, and then you got Peace Corps and USAID and all of the various tentacles of the octopus.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all infiltrated. That's what some people like your typical normie doesn't understand, is that these agencies are all infiltrated and controlled by the same octopus. It's all connected. And it's a matter of semantics, because we're talking about corporations or Hollywood or Time Life and these things, or the university system. They all tie back to the same oligarchic interests that control, the Anglo-American Zio Empire.
Yeah, and they won't let a genuine anti-war movement emerge.
It's completely shut down,
And, I mean, look at the farce of, Democracy Now, for instance. I don't have any proof, but, it looks like a duck walks like a duck. It's probably a CIA operation.
Well, if it's foundation-funded.
It is foundation funded.
But that's the problem. Yeah, everything you can with the money power, you can infiltrate everything.
Yeah,
because you simply buy people. And meaning that is just tell them, you know, they'll get, you say the right thing, you get a nice salary.
And this, to, you know, circle back on my earlier point, I mean, this is where I think that the old American right was weak, because being liberals, they will affirm, you know, the justice of democracy, and will, you know, they'll criticize corruption and cronyism. I mean, that was, I guess, more or less what John T. Flynn made his bread and butter doing. I mean, he was a muckraking journalist. But at the end of the day, they never question the idea that merchants should occupy the highest place in society.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, without, and what the argument being that you need some sort of aristocracy or monarchy, if you will.
Which yes, is, you need a state.
Yeah,
state that's above, that is above the money power.
Yeah. In a similar case, you also need an altar, a church.
Yeah, you need
And this is something that the liberal order rejects. If anything, it's marginalized. You can go to church on Sunday. It's separation church and state. It's meaningless. You know, everyone can be a Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew, but they're on the weekend, but on the rest of the week, you got to be, you know, engaged in commerce. That's the only thing that matters. Yeah. I think it was Teddy Roosevelt. I had the story told to me that he met with Franz Joseph, the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And I think Teddy Roosevelt asked him, "What do you do?" Him being a good Democrat, you know, Democratic, meaning Republican, meaning a believer in democracy, small d Democrat.
Right.
And Franz Joseph looked at him and he goes, my job is to protect my people from people like you.
Yes. You got to send me that. I'm actually working on a piece on Teddy. This is a bit of a digression, but he seems to be kind of become something of a popular figure among certain populist right dissidents now on the internet, which is pretty bizarre because Teddy was a Morgan man through and through.
Yeah. Well, the trust buster myth and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Albeit he didn't take the country to war like his oyster. Well, which one is oyster? I always mix up which one was. Oh, Hyde Park would be.
Hyde Park. Yeah. The laughing boy of Hyde Park. Yeah.
Yeah. And he would be oyster. Yeah. Unlike his Hyde Park cousin, he didn't send Americans to go die, to his credit. Another person I've been meaning to revisit, his book came out, only a couple years ago. Herbert Hoover wrote this giant memoir that only recently got published. Okay, you have it.
It's on about the run up to the Second World War, Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, apparently he took a very revisionist and sort of mea culpa approach.
A man where, again, Pearl Harbor, people like Hoover and Teddy Roosevelt, they're all obviously within the system, this shows you how this, this system isn't completely controlled. Obviously, there's differences of opinions, and there's going to be squabbles and these things. And men have a capacity to look back, and they themselves might not have understood exactly how they were being utilized. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And it seems from the little bits I have read, seems like a very honest and reflective account. It's very big, though, which is why I put off reading. I have so much to read. But
yeah, it's just that Hoover's misfortune to become president in March of 1929. So
yeah, right, exactly.
It's just a few months before the crash. So okay, well, anything else? I think we covered it. Or
yeah, it's probably good for now. I'm happy to come back whenever you'd like, though, Tim.
Great.
Enjoy talking with you.
Okay, great. Well, that's Nick Mason, co-host of Myth of the 20th Century. I urge everyone to listen to that show. It's always, always very provocative, thought-provoking. I guess that's the best place is the myth. What was that? What was the website for that again?
That's a good question. Let me check. It's I know, right? It's, you can type in myth 20C, because originally it was a WordPress, but we bought a domain. Yes, I believe if you type in myth, I don't know, my internet's being weird. Actually, no. Well, for sure, myth20c.wordpress.com.
Okay.
There is a way to get to it from .com.
And, of course, the YouTube page. So.
And, of course, the YouTube page, yes.
And the online magazine American Sun, right?
Yes, that's right.
that you can go that, check out those articles. Okay, well, listen, thanks a lot. I'll let you go.
Well, thank you, Tim.
And I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link. And if I don't talk to you now, between now, have a Merry, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.